series. And I just want to read the verse that we've been looking at the last couple of classes and move on a little further. This is chapter 2 of 2 Timothy, verse 18. Nevertheless, the foundation of God standeth sure, having this seal, the Lord knoweth them that are his, and let every one that nameth the name of Christ depart from iniquity. We're going to focus on, try to get to tonight is the Lord knoweth those that are his, and where that phrase, according to most commentaries, originates, or where Paul gets it from in the testimony. We were reading Kenneth Wiest's translation, and as I said, I'll just go here and then go on from it, but we're reading his commentary on this verse, and he said something that at first to me seemed wrong. And I guess if I saw it in the way he did and what he means, it probably would still be wrong as far as I was concerned, because he says this: the purity of the church is essential or indispensable to its security, meaning that there is no security except there be a purity there. The more pure you are, the more secure you are. You can say it that way. And that's what religion presents. The more pure you are, the more secure you are. If you have an impure thought, you are less secure now than you were before that thought. That's man's understanding, because we think God relates to us the way we relate to one another in the natural. You know, my feelings towards you can change based on your actions or your inactions. What we call relating to one another has to do really with our mood. God is not moody. It's not him about mood. God deals with us in the light of a covenant, in the light of a settled and fixed reality, in the light of a finished work, something complete. And therefore, he doesn't change at the drop of a hat. Our thoughts or lack thereof, deeds or lack thereof, doesn't help or hurt as far as God, the objective reality, as far as that goes. So when he says the purity of the church is indispensable to the security of the church, I began first to think, man, what do you mean? You're putting it all on flesh. And maybe he was. But as I began to just ponder that statement, I stayed there. I didn't just throw it away. I stayed there and thought about it. And I thought, that is absolutely true. But it's only true when you apply it to the proper man. When you apply it to the proper thing, you can't apply it to me. You can't apply it to you, because then all you're going to have is a constant cycle of assessing yourself to see whether you're pure enough to measure up, whether you're good enough to measure up, whether you've done enough to secure yourself in the sight of God. But let me inform you, there is only one who stands in the sight of God, and he is forever secured there. And he is your security there. He is the anchor for our soul. He is the one who secures the whole of Israel in his presence before the Father. He standeth in the presence or sight of God for us. That is the security of the whole. You don't measure up. You never will measure up. He is the measure of it. He is the measure of the perfection God beholds, because God beholds that one and no other. And that covenant that we've been talking about demands the singleness of this view. There is no other that can be brought into this that will corrupt the covenant. That would abrogate the covenant or do away with the covenant. The covenant is between the Father and the Son. What we're talking about here is a purity that is defined in one man. And what I was thinking is, if you realize that the purity of the church is not us, but Christ in us, then you realize that this is absolutely true. That the purity of the church is essential to its security, because you see that the only purity we have before God is Christ living in us, made unto us the perfectness of his eternal being, of his eternal person. Jimmy and I were talking about it right before the class, and the word pure, I asked him to look it up. And just listen to just the definition. I'm going to get into a lot of it here, but just the definition of the word pure and purity. And just think about who could define this. To whom can this be attributed? It is pure, and it is 2889. I think that's the Hebrew, right? 2889 in the Strong's. It means pure in a ceremonial sense. And then it's from 2891 in the Strong's. It's from that word. It means bright. It means pure. But listen to these words. It means unadulterated, uncontaminated, innocent, holy. And you can go on. I think words like undefiled. What is he says about the high priest, that it became us that we should have a high priest? Let's see, I'm trying to find that verse. Yeah, here it is. For such a high priest became us, meaning we were in need of such a high priest, who is holy, harmless, undefiled, separate from sinners, made higher than the heavens. That's what we need. That's what we needed, because what he's saying is we needed a high priest who was absolutely everything we're not. That he could stand acceptable unto God and secure a relationship with God and be made unto us a relationship with God that we had no hope of, just because of who we are by nature. Undefiled, uncorrupted, incorruptible. That puts a whole nother meaning to put the corruption, corruptible shall put on incorruption. Being clothed upon or being found in the incorruptible one, not having mine own, because mine own righteousness is what? Corruption. Filthy rags. That which is adulterated and defiled. But when we talk about the purity of the church or the purity of the saints or any of that, because that is everything about this foundation, is everything about our relationship to God, is that it is pure and perfect. If it was anything less than pure and perfect, it wouldn't exist. God would not be satisfied in it. So yes, the purity of the church is indispensable to its security, but you have to see the purity and the security of it bound up inseparably to the one man, Christ himself, the one who was in the Holy of Holies, type and shadow in the Old Testament, the one clothed with the pure white linen garments, the one accepted before God. You have to see it there. You have to see the purity of it there. And in seeing the purity of it there, you will realize the certainty and security of it there. And never again seek to find that in yourself. So, we said that in our last class, and we talked about that more. And we went into Numbers 23, looking at this, where God beholds no iniquity in Jacob, that departing from iniquity. God beholds no iniquity in Jacob, no perverseness in Israel. And basically what we were saying there is the beholding of God, God's view, is a perfect son. God's view is that one in whom there is nothing of wickedness, nothing that misses the mark, nothing that is imperfect, nothing that's incomplete. He does not, his view does not, and we've said this throughout the classes, but this says it. God's view, God's understanding with regard to you and your soul, your salvation, does not possess you as its reference point. It does not have you as its central object. If it did, he could never have uttered these words concerning Jacob, concerning Israel. He beholds a reality that is based upon covenant. He sees one. He sees his one, the one. He sees his beloved son. And that's who he sees. And the work of the Spirit is so that our soul will see the same one he is seeing. That our soul will behold the same one who is perfect in the sight of God and know him and live in the light of him as that perfection, as our own perfection. Paul says, preaching Christ in you, the hope of glory, Christ in you. He says, presenting every man perfect in Christ. That's not presenting every man perfect. That's not what it's talking about. It's not, and it's not even saying, I'm preaching to you so that one day you'll finally reach perfection. And I'll be able to present you to God perfect. That's not what he's talking about. He's saying in proclaiming Christ in you, he is proclaiming the perfection of every man. He is proclaiming the perfect salvation that is given to the soul of those who are born again. He is presenting the perfect life that is in the soul of everyone who is born again. We cannot see a perfect life looking at ourselves. We can only see the perfect life looking at the perfect man. And the glorious thing is that perfect man is our life unto God. And that perfect man is in us, and God desires to reveal him there and make him known so that we can live in the certainty of this reality of relationship with God. So we've been talking about that and about the last class we talked about departing from iniquity, and basically departing from iniquity, as far as I see it, is the soul in the seeing of Christ and the seeing of the perfect one. It is the soul being separated in realization, in understanding, in truth, from that which is contrary to God's view. God beholds no iniquity in Jacob. Anything that is contrary to that view, my soul being separated from anything that is contrary to that view. Do you know what is contrary to that view? Me. The moment I look at me, I am looking at that which is contrary to that view of God. Because all I can see when I look at me is iniquity. At my best, we can fool ourselves, make it look as good as possible. But even the perfect of sacrifices had to be offered. Only the perfect sacrifices had to be offered. Perfection in the flesh is not what God is after. We fool ourselves in thinking that's what it's about. The security of the matter is that it is not of us to any degree. It is of him. It is of him, by him, through him. It is Christ living in us as everything we are not. And this is to me, what it means to be separate or departing from iniquity is not you just stop doing bad things, or you stop, doing things that you believe are wrong. That has nothing to do with it. That will come. That may come. But that's not the goal. That's not the thing we have to push toward. That's not That's not it. I mean, I can stop doing anything. That doesn't mean there's a greater realization of life in me. I can stop doing those things and there is no greater comprehension of the life God has given to my soul. No, I look at this life, I look at the natural life, and look at the religious life and say, I'm doing better. What I'm talking about is beholding that better thing, beholding that perfect reality, that glorious reality that is within the boundaries of Christ Himself, and in my soul being separated from everything that is not within those boundaries or that has no place in those boundaries. As we said, Ezra and Nehemiah, they separated themselves from the mixed seed when the understanding of the law came. When the perfect testimony not only was read to them, but the understanding, the truth, the meaning of that law, which is Christ Himself, came into their midst, came into their understanding. He says they are people who had knowledge, who had understanding. When that understanding of the truth and meaning of the law, that happens in us in the revealing of Christ, who is the truth and meaning of the law. When that took place, there was a separation from the mixture. Because only one seed could remain there. Only one seed had right to possess that place and possess that land. To me, that's departing from iniquity. So, with that, we'll move on. I want to look again. This verse, the foundation of God stands sure, having this seal, the Lord knows them that are His. I want to look at where the commentaries say this verse comes from, or this phrase, the Lord knoweth those that are His, comes from, because to me it is a tremendous picture. And then it's going to take a little while to get through it. I may not get through it all in this class. But you see this as the beginning of God stressing over and over a tremendous point. A point that must be comprehended not only scripturally, but in our soul. We must face this understanding. We must come to comprehend this reality that is presented in this story. Now, Paul gets this, according to the commentaries, the way he words it. They say it comes from the Septuagint, the translation, the Greek translation of the Old Testament. Numbers 16:5. And 16:27, as we've already said, the Lord knoweth those that are His. That's the phrase. So let's start reading here in Numbers 16. I'm just going to start in verse 1. Now Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, and Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and on, the sons of Peleth, the sons of Reuben, took men. And they rose up before Moses with certain of the children of Israel, 250 princes of the assembly, famous in the congregation, renowned, men of renown. And they gathered themselves together against Moses and Aaron, and said unto them, you take too much upon you, seeing all the congregation are holy, every one of them, and the Lord is among them. Wherefore then lift ye up yourselves above the congregation of the Lord. And when Moses heard it, he fell upon his face. And he spake unto Korah and unto all his company, saying, even tomorrow the Lord will show who are His and who is holy. Now, in the literal Hebrew, this says, in the morning or tomorrow, the Lord will know who are his. Basically, will reveal his knowing in the midst of Israel. He will make known his knowing of those who are his. And who is holy, and he will cause him to come near unto him. Even whom he hath chosen will he cause to come near unto him. This do, take ye censers, Korah, and all his company, and put fire therein, and put incense in them before the Lord tomorrow. And it shall be that the man whom the Lord doth choose, he shall be holy. You take too much upon you, you sons of Levi. Now, to go back, I want to start here at the beginning, because there's a lot in these verses that we've just read. And it begins with what Paul says in the verses in Timothy, with the foundation of God is sure. The foundation of God is sure. There is something sure here that they are standing against. There's something that God has set, fixed, sure in their midst, that against which they now stand. They are rebelling against something God has put in their midst. And I want us to see this, because what God has done is brought Israel into a relationship that is truly governed by the cross. It is a relationship that is governed by the cross. And we're going to see that because of the destruction that will come to Korah and his company. But I want you to see that here in all of this is presented a reality that the cross has brought about. The reality of our salvation, the reality of God's knowing, the reality and sureness of this salvation that we have. It is sure. And 2 Timothy says it this way in the literal. It says, for the foundation it is sure, therefore it stands. See, it's the nature. It is firm. There is an attributive nature to that foundation. It is firm and sure. Therefore it stands. It will never be moved. God will not repent of it. God will not move it for anyone, no matter how great you think your argument is. No matter how right you think your position is, there is a fixed and settled reality that God has put in the midst. That's why it's called the rock of offense, the stumbling stone. It is something that will not move for you. It is a fixed and settled issue in the heart and mind of God, and it stands immovable. Thayer's defines it as immovable. The foundation is immovable. We talked about it in earlier classes that the word sure also means obstinate, which means unmovable, unyielding to any contradiction. Standeth is in the perfect tense. It stands sure. It is in the perfect tense. Literally, it has stood. This is 2 Timothy again. That it stands because it's sure. The word stand there is in the perfect tense, which means literally it can be said this way. It has stood with the present result that it permanently stands. You see that? It has stood. It's always eternally stood. And the present reality is it permanently stands. See, that's what we're dealing with here. That's what we've come to. Something that is so eternally sure and fixed that it's permanently standing. God. We've already stressed this to some degree. But much like the rest of Hebrews 4, it remains, the remaining of a rest. Remember, there remaineth a rest for the children of God. It is not that there remains one yet to come or yet to be brought, yet it remains to still be fulfilled. No, it's not about that. It remains because it is a settled issue that will never, ever move. It is God's own possession, God's eternal Sabbath. It's God's eternal rest. Therefore, it remains for those who will come and be found in the Son in whom He is perfectly spoken and fulfilled. The Amen, the so be it of God. That's His rest, and that rest remains for those who will come and know that rest by faith. Who will live in that rest, the rest of not I, but Christ who liveth in me. And that's the very thing these men were standing against. And I'll show it to you here in these verses. So I want to examine this story because in this I think we'll see the gravity, the weightiness of the grace that God has given to the soul of man, and the natural reaction of man in the light of this grace. I'm telling you, the grace of God is not this flowery thing it's been made to be recently. God just loves you so much because He's just in love with you. Yes, He loves us, but there's a specific way in which He has loved us. There is a love of God that is shed abroad in our hearts. Yes, but it's not just, oh, He loves me, He loves you, He loves everybody. No, He loves His Son. And the love that He has shed abroad in each of our hearts is that He has given to that heart the Son of His love. The grace of God is defined in the cross. The grace of God is defined that God's love is not about me and you. God's love is His Son living in me and you. The grace of God is not about all of us empowered to live holy unto God. The grace of God is that He has given to my soul the only life that is acceptable to Him. That's the grace, that one lives accepted, and the one who lives accepted unto the Father is the one that He has bestowed unto my soul. That's what it talks about, has in grace or through grace bestowed unto us. And we have no comprehension of what He has given, but we have been given the Spirit that we may know what He has in grace bestowed. That's 1 Corinthians chapter 2. I'm talking about what the grace of God has bestowed to the soul. What the true grace of God has given to the soul is an offense to the natural mind. I want you to understand this. We're seeing men stand up against the very grace of God, falling from grace, if you would use the vernacular of Paul, because the grace of God is an offense to religion. It is an offense to the natural man, because the grace of God is that there is one who lives before me. And thank God that the grace of God has bestowed that one to my soul. But what it does is leaves you with only one relationship with God. It leaves you with one righteousness before God. It leaves you with one holiness before God. It leaves you dependent upon the one who lives in you. We're going to get in. I'm getting way ahead. Let me read this. We'll see the gravity or the weightiness of the grace of God that has been given, and we'll see the natural man's reaction to this grace. To this fixed and singular nature of the grace of God. Singular nature. to God's knowing, God's relating to us. We will see that the sure foundation sealed in the knowing of God is the stone or rock of offense upon which man will stumble. Isaiah 8:14, he shall be for a sanctuary, but for a stone of stumbling and for a rock of offense to both houses. He is a sanctuary. Go to Hebrews where he talks about those who have fled, basically fled for sanctuary, to be found in him. Hebrews 6. But to others he is the rock of offense. But he is a sanctuary for those who will be found in him, not having anything of their own. The offense is that you can't bring anything of your own here. The offense is there is nothing of you that has place here. It's of him and not of us. That's a relationship governed by the cross. That's the true relationship of a new creation. Not I, but Christ. That's not just a phrase we throw around, people. That's the reality we come to the moment we are born of the Spirit of Christ. Not I, but Christ. And it may take forever for us to awaken to that reality, but that is the reality nonetheless. And there is something in the heart of man that stands contrary to it and fights it. There is something in the heart of man that will stand against that. Like it says here, they stood against Moses and Aaron. It will stand against that because it says, what about me? What about my part? What about my place? What about my blessing? Haven't you reserved a blessing for me, Father? No, I have blessed him, and he shall remain blessed. And to bring it for us, and if you will have any blessing at all from me, you will be found in him who has made unto you all spiritual blessings. He is the blessing of God unto us. But that's the whole thing that is offensive to the natural man. We have to be found in him, not having anything of our own to know anything of the blessing. We don't get a bunch of stuff. That's what we want. We get him as everything. And that seems so insignificant and so small and so insufficient to the natural man. And then we just cry to God, what about me? There's got to be something of me here. He's not enough. Who does he think he is? You've set him up above us? Yes. You understand, Moses and Aaron didn't make a decision, hey, we're gonna be overlords over the... No, God set them above. God put them in the position as a testimony of one who would be above. We're talking about an above understanding here. What did we just read about the high priest in Hebrews? That he is higher than the heavens, above the heavens, exalted. That's the high priest that we needed. And there's something still in the heart that stumbles upon it because we want a place for us. We want our blessing. We want God to, just like Cain, we want God to give respect to our offering. And one of the translations says he didn't even acknowledge Cain or his offering. It's like he didn't even exist. Because really in the sight of God, he didn't. As to his offering, he didn't. One stands before me. That's the governing reality of this new creation. That's the governing reality of this relationship against which they are gathering and standing here in number 16. they rose up against Moses and Aaron. I wrote here, it's vital that we first consider the scene set forth in these verses to get the impact of what takes place and how it applies to what Paul is declaring in Timothy. It starts here with the phrase, gathered themselves against Moses and Aaron. So I wrote out of a commentary, this is the Keelan Delitzsch commentary, Jimmy. The leader was, this is from their commentary, this is a quote from there. The leader was Korah, and the rebels are called, in consequence, Korah's company. He and to the high priesthood, or at least he claimed, he laid a claim in his heart, in his mind, Korah, laid a claim to the high priesthood, or at least to an equality with Aaron. Among its associates were the Reubenites, Dathan and Abram, or I can't read my writing, Obron, who no doubt were unable to get beyond the fact that the birthright had been taken away from their ancestor, and with it the headship over the house of Israel. You see that? They couldn't get over the fact that the birthright had been taken from them and given to another. Haven't you a blessing reserved for me? I've blessed him. He has the inheritance. He has the blessing. So the whole question exposing, I wrote here, or they wrote, I can't remember if I wrote this or they did, exposing the question of Galatians 3 and 4, to whom does the great inheritance belong? To whom does the promises belong? Us or him? Apparently their intention was to seize upon the government of the nation under a self-appointed high priest. You see, you hear that? Self-appointed high priest. Forcing Moses and Aaron out of the post assigned by God. That is to say, to overthrow the constitution which God had given to his people. So they set themselves against Moses and Aaron. And they say this to them, you take too much upon you, seeing that all the congregation are holy. Now, the phrase you take too much upon you, when I begin to look at that in the Hebrew, when you look those words up, it's very telling of what's going on here, what their mindset is here. And it speaks to something tremendous. The word upon you means it belongs to, or regard to you. Means it belongs to you. You think something belongs to you. You take too much upon you. Too much, the word too much in the Hebrew, is a word that means abundant in quantity, size, age, rank, quality. It means exceedingly great, full, increased, plenteous, sufficient. And I begin to see in their confrontation of Moses and Aaron, the thing that offended them, but it was also the truth which with regard to Moses and Aaron. I want you to consider this with me. The word means plenteous, sufficient. And it means belonging to you. You take too much upon you. Belonging to you is plenteous sufficiency. Who do you think you are? Do you think you, that the sufficiency of this whole nation, that the greatness and the exceeding greatness and fullness and fulfillment and prosperity and riches of this nation belongs to you? Do you see that? Here's the offense. I wrote it down. Their offense and their rebellion was in reference to a sufficiency, an increase, a fullness, an abundance that belonged to these men and not to themselves. They saw this. It belonged to Moses and Aaron and not to them. And that offended them. They, the abundance of the whole, everything belonged to these men, the whole of it, and not to them. I think I was thinking about that in the light of what Paul says when he has the revelation and he sees that which the law would not permit him to speak, things unlawful to utter, he says in 2 Corinthians 12. And that's what that means, that the law would not allow him to speak. He sees that. And God spoke to him and said, after he says what he says, and he prayed for the thorn to be removed from his flesh, the thorn of flesh in his flesh to be removed three times. And God said, my grace is sufficient. The grace that I have, the grace that I am in you is thine own sufficiency. That's my grace is sufficient for you. The sufficiency of it. When you look this word sufficient up in 2 Corinthians 12:9, it means content, enough, be sufficient. It carries the idea of raising a barrier to keep safe and secure. My grace is thine own sufficiency. Meaning, I am your sufficiency. The very reality that I live in you is your sufficiency. That I am made unto you everything you're not, that is your own sufficiency. And you have no sufficiency except that grace. You understand, this is a man who has seen into the Holy of Holies, the third heaven, who has seen the one who the law would not allow to be spoken, who the law kept hidden. And that one declares, I am thine own sufficiency. I live, you do not. And that fact is your sufficiency. Therefore he says, I desire, I rejoice, I boast in my weakness, in my insufficiency, in not having anything of my own, that the sufficiency and power of him may tabernacle, or I may be clothed upon with his own sufficiency, being found in him. See, he understood that the only secure, the only true secure place before God was to be found in Christ, having nothing of his own. And boasting in nothing except the Lord himself, who has made unto him all spiritual things. And these men are standing in contradiction to that reality. That God had said in their midst, the offense was that these men, all sufficiency, all fullness, all abundance belonged, let's just say it this way, just for us, belonged to Christ and not to themselves. I wrote here, religion and the works of religion flows out from an inward condition that rises up against an eternal determination that God has set in order, and that is that in this one all fullness will dwell. All abundance, all fullness, all sufficiency dwells here. My satisfaction in its fullness, in its eternal fullness, dwells here. God has determined it to be so. Therefore, we have to see that Korah and his company were not merely opposing two men with whom they disagreed. Moses and Aaron represent the one fixed and authorized, unchangeable relationship God had set in the midst of Israel. They are basically a twofold, if you want to say it that way, testimony of Christ himself. But let's look at something here that they say, and we'll go back to this. I'm running out of time in this class, and I apologize, I haven't got too far, but all the, listen to this, you take too much upon you, seeing all the congregation are holy. The first thing that I saw there was the assumption of possessing something separate from this one that God had put in their midst. We're holy. We're all holy here. And that's so absurd when you look at it in the light of the high priest that we've been presenting throughout these classes. When you look at it there, you see the perversity of these statements. You see how perverse the heart of man is in the light of eternal things, wanting his place, the lust of the flesh, wanting his position, wanting his place, assuming he has something that belongs to him. And it exposed their true ignorance with regard to the reality that God had ordered and set in their midst. All the congregation is holy. This is the false perception that exists in most Christians. The cross, that salvation has made them holy, righteous, or even given them the right or the means to obtain such attributes. But that is a perception based upon a sense of separation from the head himself. Not holding the head. Remember, when he talks about all fullness in him and how he presents all of that, the thing that he says about those who would take them away from such sufficiency and fullness is that they are not holding the head. They are disregarding the head out from whom all the substance flows, who is the source and substance of the whole thing. They're trying to obtain something that only he is. They're trying to possess something that he alone has right to. Ignorance and rebellion against God, giving to the soul one son that was made unto them all things. Listen to this. This is what they're standing against. Listen to this verse out of Exodus 28:36. Let me read 36 through 38. I'm going to turn there. Exodus 28, 36 through 38. And thou shalt make a plate of pure gold. This is in the making of the garments of the high priest. Thou shalt make a plate of pure gold, engrave upon it like the engravings of a signet, holiness to the Lord. And thou shalt put it on a blue lace, that it may be upon the mitre, upon the forefront of the mitre it shall be. Listen to verse 38 now. This is the thing that they are standing against. And it shall be upon Aaron's forehead, that Aaron may bear the iniquity of the holy things which the children of Israel shall hallow in all their holy gifts. And it shall be always upon his forehead, that they may be accepted before the Lord. Do you see the security of that? Do you see how the whole are identified in the one? Do you see how the whole are secured in the head of one man? Let me read it again. It shall always be upon his forehead, that they may be accepted in the sight of the Lord. All of us are holy. The only holiness they had was the one standing in their midst that had an engraved signet upon his head that said, "Holy unto God." You see the absurdity of that statement? And that's why when Moses heard all of this, he hit his face on the ground. He fell before God and began to pray. Why? Because he, unlike us, understood the gravity of standing against such a fixed reality. He understood God had set something in order and they were standing against what God had wrought in their midst. It wasn't going to change what God had wrought in their midst, but they were going to face the destruction of standing against it. This has brought about a real, true fear of the Lord in my heart of attempting to relate to God in a way that is contrary to his knowing. Because all that is, all of our attempts to relate to God, all of our attempts to be good, to be holy, to be righteous, to be like Jesus, all of that is an affront to this fixed reality that he set in our midst. And I promise you, we, in our soul's experience, in our relation, in however you want to say it, will face. Let me just say it this way. I have it written here later, but let me say it before the end of the class. To be carnally minded is death. To be spiritually minded is life and peace. In your literal translation, there's no "is" there. It says, to be carnally minded, death. Same thing. There's no distinction. It's not, this is the result of this. This is, to be carnally minded, death. Carnally minded, death. Spiritually minded, that means the mind of the Spirit, life, peace. Why? Because when the mind, the carnal mind of man is present and he's perceiving anything, it's him in view. Which is what? Death. Destruction. Separation from God. And trying to know anything of reality, anything of spiritual reality, because the carnal mind loves to attempt to peer into those things of God. But all you see is death, and you will face, we will face that death. We will, and here's the death. The death is nothing more than separation from the congregation. You'll see that here in this story. Death is being swallowed up in the earth and separated from the congregation. Most of us live in such a state of separation. Separated from the congregation that is defined in this statement. Israel is my son. Why? Because we haven't seen the son who is the defining and measure of Israel. So we stand against it in our hearts. That's just the nature of man. We stand against it. Why? I want to be holy too. I want to have my place here. And the reality is, the reality that governs this relationship is, there is only one who will stand before me. And you will either be found in him or you will face destruction. That's why the warnings of Hebrews are so strong and so severe. Because to neglect this great salvation is to neglect everything that your soul was created for. And God has no other option for you. Because God has his satisfaction. God has his Sabbath. God has his rest. And he has in this grace offered that rest to my soul. This is the grace. This is the grace. One stands before me. The grace is that one is in me. That one lives in me. He is in the midst. God has put that one in the midst as my only life unto God. But most But most of the time, there is this conflict because I want my place. I want my part. I want to stand before God too. And that's one of the reasons, and we're out of time, that's one of the reasons Paul, see, when he says, it was not unto seeds as of many, but unto thy seed who is Christ, he's not just correcting an ethnic situation there. He's not just saying, oh no, it's not the Jews. It's not many Jews. No, that's not about the... No, he's not merely correcting that, some nationalistic view that was there. He is presenting the sure singularity of God's knowledge with regard to all. One seed. And you'll see that in this with Korah. After Korah's destruction, God will say, now make this memorial so that they will all know one seed will stand before me. That memorial comes in the face of Christ. That understanding comes in the face of Jesus Christ. One. In the seeing of the one upon whose head, the only one, upon whose head, holy unto God, is engraved. When you see him, you will understand how absurd you were to ever think you were holy too. And you'll know how absurd it was for you to ever seek it by any other means, but be found in him. Not having mine own holiness. Not having mine own righteousness. That's your only place of sureness. That's your only place of security. Paul had a standing before God he assumed until he saw the more excellent man. And by reason of seeing that man, he counted everything else as dung. His place, to be found in him. His pursuit, to know him. His desire, to apprehend him, in whom I have been apprehended of God. You understand? It's a man governed by the reality of the cross. It's a man governed by the knowledge of God. One stands before me. And may that knowledge come in our hearts so we do not stand in rebellion toward this great salvation. Rebellion and rebelling and counting as nothing, or as Paul would say, what is it? Frustrating the grace of God. Because the grace of God is the singleness of his vision, the singleness of his view, that perspective that is singular in its nature, because it is one man who stands there accepted before him. That's the grace of God. One living in me unto God. And in that, as I behold that one, there can be a reckoning in my soul. There can be a true reckoning in the light of that one who is my life, that I am dead unto sin and alive unto God through him. Yes, but never separate. Nothing of our salvation will ever be known separate from this one God has set in the midst of Israel. All right, we'll stop there and pick up in our next class. Sorry I didn't get very far. But we'll pick it up in our next class.